call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. And we have three bills up for public hearing and possible work session today. We'll start with Senate Bill 102A, open a public hearing on that bill. I have four folks signed up to testify. If you're here on the bill and didn't sign up, please let Sue know and she'll let me know. But let's start with Andy Ginsberg from DEQ to tell us about the bill. Members, you'll find in your packets, Beth's telling me, that we'll find in our packets on the bill, and including the usual materials, a measure history that will describe its history in the Senate, and then the fiscals, since these bills had to move out of their Senate committees with fiscals, so we're past that point. Unless we amend the bill, of course, we'll need a new one. Go ahead, Andy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and here to provide information and ask for your support for Senate Bill 102, which would reduce emissions from wood stoves in Oregon. And if I could draw your attention to the written testimony on the very last page, you'll see a chart that looks like this. And, no?
Oh, yes.
The purpose of this bill is to reduce particulate emissions, and this shows you a current snapshot of where we are in Oregon with regard to meeting the federal air quality standards for fine particulates. The dark line at 35 is the standard, and you can see that there are a number of bars representing individual cities in Oregon that are above the standard. The two dark ones, the darkest ones, Oak Ridge and Klamath Falls, are officially violating the federal air quality standards. They've been designated by EPA as non-attainment, and we're required to put together attainment plans for them. The other areas that are above the line are not official yet because we don't have 3 full years' worth of data, but those are on their way to becoming non-attainment areas if the next couple of winters are the same as the last couple of winters. And then you can see many other areas with elevated particulate levels. Anything that's above 25 on this chart are areas we consider of concern. We're watching them. Over 25 is potential health effects, but not quite high enough to violate the federal standards. So this is what we're concerned about. If you look on the other side of that page, you'll see a pie chart. And the pie chart shows a typical inventory of where the fine particulate emissions come from in one of these areas on a winter day. And the reason we're interested in a winter day is that's when we typically violate the standards. We'll have an inversion, and smoke from a variety of sources can build up in the non-attainment area. And you can see on a typical winter day in one of these areas that residential wood combustion dominates the chart. Obviously, there are other sources, industry, cars, open burning, but wood stoves are a big source in all of these areas. So this bill is trying to address wood stoves. And
Before you move on, I want to just come back to this chart that shows several locations not meeting the daily standard. Is that an average throughout the year, or is this on a certain number of winter days? What is this actually displaying? You know, when I look at Oak Ridge and see what 40... 37, what does that mean?
So, Mr. Chair, these are the standard is based on a 3-year average of the fourth highest value. So so these are areas that we're looking at the 24-hour standard. So it's a day that violates the federal standard. If you violate it on the fourth highest day on average over 3 years, you're officially designated non-attainment. That's in the federal definition.
Thanks.
So so this bill does several things to reduce wood stove emissions. Right now we have something like 300,000 homes in Oregon that use wood stoves, and about half of those wood stoves are uncertified. That means they were built more than 20 years ago when we and then later EPA started certifying stoves. So they have the oldest and dirtiest stoves. And the purpose of this bill is to accelerate the turnover, so we remove the old uncertified stoves and replace them with cleaner certified stoves or pellet stoves or gas or any other cleaner form of heat. And the way the bill does that is by requiring when a home is sold, if it has an uncertified stove, then that stove would be removed at that time. The several local communities have already adopted ordinances with the same provision, and we have in Ashland, Lakeview, Bend, Medford, Jackson County, Klamath County have already all adopted ordinances requiring removal of uncertified stoves when a home is sold. This would essentially take those ordinances and make a uniform statewide requirement. And it is supported by the Oregon Realtors Association because that way they will only have one provision to deal with that's consistent statewide. The bill also authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to set standards for stoves that are exempt from EPA's program. When EPA first adopted the program, a few small categories of stoves were exempt. Now there are many, many types of things that to you or I would look like a wood stove that technically don't meet EPA's definition. And the bill would also allow our commission to set to update the standards for wood stoves if EPA fails to act. EPA's standards are now 20 years old, and they have begun the process of updating their standards. We're very hopeful that they will, but the bill would allow the Environmental Quality Commission to update them if EPA doesn't. We've worked very closely with the Hearth Products Association on this bill, and we've given them our commitment. I'd just like to repeat it on the record that we intend to wait for EPA to take action on this, and that we would only take action if EPA fails to take action. And if EPA does fail, then we would stay consistent with what the state of Washington has already done. And then there's one final thing this bill does, which is prohibits the burning of certain materials that are already prohibited to be burned outside in open burn piles. But there's a loophole in the law that currently allows those same things to be burned in your fireplace or in your wood stove. And so those prohibited materials would be things like plastic and treated wood that otherwise you can't burn on a burn pile. And just to clarify that you also can't burn those in your fireplace. So the bill had some amendments in the Senate, and those amendments were designed to improve the implementation. For example, one issue that came up was that, let's say you bought a new wood stove today and installed it in your home, and then next year EPA updates the standards, and then the year after that you sell your home. Well, obviously we don't want to pull that practically brand new wood stove out of a home. And so the bill requires that we wait at least 15 years before a wood stove would have to be removed. So even though EPA is likely to update the standards, a stove that's only a few years old is going to be pretty clean. The ones we're really interested in are the ones that are over 20 years old that are still out there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Andy. Let's see. Questions for the committee. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps not particularly relevant to the exact subject of the bill, but I'm just curious, given your pie chart. The pie chart that you have here is the breakdown for fine particulate pollution, and it shows an enormous share from residential wood combustion. To what degree is fine particulate what we see when we think of air pollution, and what's the overall composition of when we think of haze, fine particulate versus, say, tropospheric ozone or VOCs or NOx or whatever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, so fine particulate, are the smallest particles, so we think of them more as coming from smoke. So it's typically combustion sources, whether it's wood stoves or open burning or, you know, industrial wood combustion, as compared to larger, coarser particulate, which you could think of more as dust or re-entrained dust level. So in the winter, if you're in one of these areas in an inversion and you see haze in the air, it's likely from fine particulate. In the summer, if you see haze in the air, it's more likely that it's going to be from smog or ozone. So it's kind of a seasonal thing. That the composition, fine particulate is made up of many, many different chemicals. It's regulated based on its size, so it really is, it's the particle size that's important, because the small particles are able to break through your defenses, get through your nose and your throat and deep into your lungs. But then it's those various chemicals, combustion products typically, that are adhered onto the surface of the particles that can cause additional problems. So in essence, you can think of the fine particle as a delivery mechanism to bring toxic chemicals deep into your lungs where they can lodge, and it's difficult for your body to remove them. So it may have included on it things called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are carcinogens, it may have associated with it benzene and many other combustion products that come along with burning wood or burning petroleum or anything. Did that answer the question?
You did. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, the definition of solid fuel burning device limits these to the in a private residential structure or commercial establishment. this is, so every one of these devices, it has to be indoors, is that correct?
That's correct.
The, on section 6, page 3, there's a list of prohibited materials, those which you can't burn in a solid fuel burning device. Is this prohibition then one that comes up later in the penalty discussion we're going to have later on one of these other bills?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, theoretically, it could be these, if these materials are burned inside in a fireplace by an individual homeowner, the bill doesn't include within it any type of an inspection program or enforcement program. So we would rely primarily on a complaint from a neighbor to let us know that someone's burning plastic in their fireplace, for example, and they would get a courtesy phone call or letter or visit from DEQ, and very unlikely would it ever result in enforcement in that kind of scenario. But theoretically, it could, and the bill you're going to hear later today talks about the maximum potential enforcement penalties. Those types of penalties don't apply to homeowners. Much lower penalty tables apply to homeowners than would apply to, say, a large industrial facility. And I probably should allow our enforcement folks to talk about that more when they talk about Senate Bill 105. So there could be a connection, Representative Bentz, but in reality, this is going to be an educational program.
Hello.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am trying to get to the reality of it. So what is the reality of it? If someone does this, will they be violating something for which they could be legally penalized?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, it's theoretically possible. Under our enforcement guidance, we would normally have several levels of technical assistance, you know, education and warning before anything would rise to the level of enforcement. If, for example, you had a large, let's say, a business that was burning a large volume of these prohibited materials inside a wood heating device, theoretically that could result in enforcement. The more likely scenario here is that a homeowner is burning some garbage or plastic in a fireplace, and that would result in a warning.
Hello.
Okay. I'm trying to get to not what is likely or what is theoretical. I'm trying to get to what the law will be. And so for that purpose, I want to know your opinion of whether or not this is going to be prohibited. If someone violates it, what's the worst that could happen to them? And I'm talking about a residential owner. And if it's follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
If it's going to come up later in that other discussion, that's fine with me. I just want to know if in Section 6, if someone throws a paper plate on their fire, if they can anymore under the device that's allowed, what is the maximum penalty to which they would be subject? And if that's going to come up later, then I'll ask the question later.
Well, you can come on up and address it now.
Chair Cannon, excuse me, Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz. My name is Les Carl. I'm Senior Policy Advisor in Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality. I believe the question is, what would be the worst that could happen for someone violating this bill? So under current statutes, any person who violates an air quality statute, rule, permit, order could be possibly subject to a maximum of $10,000 a day in penalties. That's the maximum that would apply under the statutes. There are rules that govern considerations that we must make in establishing what the actual penalty would be. And residents fall out very low on those matrix, which Mr. Ginsburg was talking about. So it's very unlikely that any penalty would be assessed at all for these, but there is this statutory maximum that would apply in these cases.
Will you be providing sort of documentation of the rules related to this penalty matrix, perhaps in your testimony on the later bill, or can you provide that to the committee?
We can provide it. Yes, sir. It wasn't going to be part of my testimony today, but we can provide that.
I think that would be helpful. Thanks, Representative Bentz.
Thank you for indulging, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking now at page 3 of SB 102, line 15, trash burner means any equipment that is used to dispose of waste by burning. Does this take us outside the house? Are we still in the house? Is this entire bill directed again toward in residential use, or does this take us outside the house?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, this entire bill applies to residential solid fuel heating devices. So it's possible that there are other structures associated with the house, like an outbuilding or something like that. A shed could be covered, but based on the size cutoffs that are in this bill, it does not apply to any type of commercial or industrial type boiler or burner or anything like that.
Chair.
Go ahead.
Andy, I'm just trying to get at whether if someone has a 50-gallon drum outside their house burning trash in it, would they be prohibited from doing so by this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's already prohibited. This is trying to plug the loophole where if you're burning these materials in a fireplace, it's a loophole in the current law. But this would essentially make the requirements for fireplaces the same as it is for a trash barrel or an open burn pile.
Thank you.
What would the impacts be of failing to meet the federal standards? So we have several communities that appear not to be meeting or on a path to not meeting. What is there some consequence for failure to meet the federal clean air standard?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the first thing that happens when we violate the federal air quality standards, we're required to put together what's known as an attainment plan, and that plan includes all the enforceable measures that the state plans to take to bring the air back into compliance with the federal standard. While you're developing your plan, automatic Clean Air Act requirements come into play that affect large industrial facilities and industrial facilities that want to expand, so that they are required to put on very expensive emission controls and obtain emission offsets for any increases that they cause. So the whole time that an area is in non-attainment, it's much more difficult for economic development to occur. Then once we bring the area back into attainment, then those industrial sanctions can be lifted, and assuming that they weren't necessary to attain the standard. If we fail to put a plan together, then additional sanctions can come into play. The federal government can withhold federal highway funds from the state, and they can also make the industrial restrictions even more stringent. Ultimately, they can issue a federal attainment plan. Those types of scenarios don't happen very frequently. Sometimes they're threatened. They haven't happened in Oregon because we've managed to always meet the deadlines and submit our attainment plans.
I think that's a really important point, and one that I hope the committee will bear in mind as we consider this issue. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Andy, this bill just prohibits or just kind of gets the older wood stoves out. But then Representative Benz asked a question about burn barrels outside. What's that part?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, so burn barrels aren't affected by this bill. He was just asking, I believe, if they were. This is really focused on residential wood heating devices.
Five. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Betts.
I'm sorry. I hate to go up on burn barrels, but I thought you indicated those were already prohibited.
It's already not legal to burn garbage and plastic and things like that in a burn barrel outside. And what this bill does is there's a loophole in the current law that would allow those types of materials to be burned in a fireplace. So this just brings the inside requirements to be the same as the outside requirements.
Representative Boone.
I'm not aware that it's not legal to use a burn barrel outside, because our state forestry department regularly sends the fire department, because it's in our house, a list of approved burn permits. And I'm assuming those are burn barrel during the fire season that you could burn, the burning season.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, just to be clear, burn barrels are not illegal. It's just burning plastic in them.
Got it. Oh, okay. Okay. That helps. Thanks.
Stick around, Andy, and we'll see what else might emerge during the rest of this public hearing.
Thank you.
Let's have John Frankel and Harvey Gale.
Thanks for bringing that away. Chair Kennan, members of the committee, my name is Harvey Gale. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. And we are here today in support of Senate Bill 102, the Heat Smart Bill. Our industry represents manufacturers, distributors, installers, and retailers of hearth appliances. And these would be wood stoves, pellet stoves, gas appliances, and that of that nature. The hearth business in Oregon is a significant business. It represents $20 million, and typically our members are small businesses. We have manufacturers in Oregon and distributors in Oregon and a lot of installers and chimney sweeps all related to the hearth industry. At this time, I'd like to introduce John Frankel, who will talk, make a few points about the bill.
Good afternoon, Chairman Cannon and representative of the committee. My name is John Frankel and is president of the Oregon Hearth, Patio, Barbecue Association. I'm here to urge support for Senate Bill 102. First of all, our association is very satisfied with the level of involvement that we've had with DEQ in drafting and improving this legislation. And we're supporting it for the following three reasons. One, it correctly removes dirty burning wood stoves from Oregon's airshed. The newer certified stoves are 7 to 10 times more effective in removing particulate matter. It's also a public safety issue that those stoves that are out there typically had a lifespan in their venting of about 20 years. So they're kind of reaching the end of their safe lives and need to be removed from Oregon homes. Secondly, this measure protects jobs by not going to the extremes of unnecessarily banning all wood stoves. We understand that that the questions may arise about all wood stoves and about the concerns regarding particulate matter, but it's proven that that these uncertified stoves are really the main culprit and the low-hanging fruit in resolving our particulate matter issues in the state. And thirdly, that improves economic opportunity for small businesses as wood stove changeouts will become necessary. As Harvey mentioned, this is an industry that is comprised of a lot of small businesses. Distributors, manufacturers, installers, service people, all that would be involved in changing out these unnecessary or uncertified wood stoves. We also would like to stress that because this bill gives wider authority to EQC, that we believe that the rulemaking process will become very, very important, particularly as we get beyond 2010, and that we intend to be very involved in this rulemaking process. But we urge support and passage of this legislation. And any questions at this time?
I'm not familiar with your association. Could you say a little more about who you represent, who your members are?
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, our association is the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. We're the Oregon affiliate of the National HPBA, or Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association, and we represent retailers of fireplaces, installers of fireplaces, those who service fireplaces, people who distribute and manufacture fireplaces and wood stoves. In fact, in Salem, we do have a wood stove manufacturer, and so the industry is viable. In fact, Oregon, was probably the cradle of the modern wood stove that was developed in the 1970s. They were developed here, and the pellet stove. So Oregon is really the founder of a lot of these things. But now it's time for the industry to help in addressing those stoves that are still out there, those that are 20 years old or more. They need to be replaced. They're dirty burning, and there is much, much better technology available now that's 10 times more efficient and less polluting than those older stoves. So,
do you have a sense of how many jobs are associated with this industry in Oregon?
We've had that question asked before. I'm not sure we have an exact number on that. I will say with $20 million in business, that's a significant amount of employment that we represented there. We have lots of retailers in Oregon. There's probably 200 or more hearth retailers. There's probably an equal number of installers and chimney sweeps. We have several large distributors and manufacturers also, and they represent larger companies. So I'd say it's fairly significant.
Sweet. Well, Representative Bertram.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I want to make sure I understand what 10 times or 7 times means. If I were to interpret it, I would assume that it means that a 7-time stove would only produce 14% of the pollution that an old stove does, and a 10-time stove would produce 10%. Is that a reasonable way of reading it, or should I understand it some other way?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, The best way to look at it is to look at the specific grams per hour emission of certified stoves, which is in the range of 4 to 7.5 grams per hour. The uncertified stoves were approximately 7 to 10 times that.
Thank you. I think we had the same interpretation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, do you have any idea of how many stoves we're looking at? What do we have any feel for how big the problem is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the number could be somewhere between 150,000 to 300,000 stoves in the state of Oregon. And that's a number that I think DEQ also confirms.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your input on this bill. Appreciate it. Let's bring Sue Fratt, John Ledger, and Bill Kluding. Mr. Ledger, go ahead and make room for Bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. We're hoping that you can find a way, and I think you can, to pass this bill out. It might need a little work here or there to address your concerns. Non-attainment areas have been around for a long time. We've had great success in dealing with them. They're starting to pop up again now because the standards are changing primarily. But when you do have a non-attainment area, it makes it very difficult to expand an industry or locate an industry in the area. And particulate matter, especially from stoves, seems to be a nasty material. And we're concerned that this would slow down economic growth that our members need. It's not good for their employees, another thing. And we think this looks like a pretty innovative, pretty painless way to get at this problem. And so we hope that, you know, whatever concerns can be ironed out here, and we would certainly like to see non-attainment areas addressed as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kluding.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Committee for the record, Bill Kluding, Industrial Carpenters Workers. I know this is a very important issue. I just have a couple questions. How does the Department of Environmental Quality, when we have our major forest fires on in the West, like last year when Southern California was on fire, the whole Willamette Valley was blanketed with a blue haze. When the Sandy Ann fire was burning, it affected us. Do they turn off their measuring devices again? Or the point I'm getting at is, as we speak, the U.S. Forest Service right now in the Bend area, using some of the stimulus dollars, they're thinning and cleaning up some of the forests, but they're also burning. And just last week they decided to have a public comment period on their burning. I'd just like to know what, on the graph and on the pie chart, how much the smoke from these major fires interferes with what the valley or what our state puts out, if I may ask that question, sir.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Andy, do you want to come up and answer it now?
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Andy Ginsberg with DEQ. The gentleman is correct that forestry burning is also a significant source of fine particulate, but it's not a primary contributor to violations of the federal standard, because when we have violations of the standard, it tends to be in the winter, which is typically not when the forestry burning is occurring, and it tends to be when there's an inversion, so the air inside the non-attainment area is trapped inside, and that same inversion keeps any air pollution from outside from moving in. So it is part of the background air pollution, but it's not a primary cause of violations of our non-attainment areas. We have we work very closely with the Oregon Department of Forestry to minimize the impacts of burning. One of the things that they do to try and reduce the impacts from wildfires is to use controlled or prescribed burning, where they can reduce the risk of wildfires, improve forest health, and manage the smoke so that we avoid having impacts on populated areas. So we do very much work on reducing impacts from forestry burning, but forestry burning is not a primary cause of violations of the federal particulate standard.
So let me make sure I understand this correctly. So as unpleasant as summer days may be in many parts of the state when there are forest fires, the air quality is not as bad as it is in certain communities on certain days of the winter due to inversions and wood stove smoke.
And Mr. Chair, just to expand on that just a little bit, for a couple of hours, it could be very bad, but when you average it over a 24-hour period, which is the federal standard, it's not likely to exceed the standard enough times to cause a violation.
Okay.
So remember, it has to be the fourth highest value averaged over 3 years. So in addition, wildfires, if they're natural events, aren't even counted by EPA in a violation mode. You know, we track them, we record them, we pay attention to them, but they don't count as a violation if they're a wildfire or a natural event that's not otherwise controllable.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Go ahead.
Oh, pardon me, Andy. Chair Cannon and members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Sue Fratt. I'm the CEO of the American Lung Association in Oregon. I'm here representing the American Lung Association and to support the passage of Senate Bill 102. Our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. And while wood smoke may smell wonderful and have a lot of warm emotional feelings tied to it, it is not good for you. It is a mixture of noxious gases and fine particulate matter, which has previously been discussed here. The health detriment is it can negatively affect people with congestive heart failure, angina, COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, folks with emphysema and asthma. It also has a serious negative effect on our older population, which are people more susceptible to those previously mentioned diseases, and children who are possibly suffering from asthma, but the fact that their respiratory rate is higher and as they exercise outside, they inhale deeper and these particles get into their lungs. And with our concern about the fact that energy costs are rising, that people will be turning to heating their homes in the wintertime with these older wood stove devices, that this program really is a way to address helping the health of Oregonians to help their lung diseases and to provide broad public health measures. You will see on my handed distributed comments on the backside there are some statistics that represent really the impact that even smaller amounts of these change out programs across the nation have had serious positive impact on reducing fine particulate matter. So I would ask for your support on this bill, and I would just leave you with the thought that when you can't breathe, really nothing else matters, and this will help Oregonians continue to breathe, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I know that there's a 15-year time frame timeout on that, but I'm wondering, I have a number of constituents in my district who heat with wood, including myself, mm-hmm. and I can't even tell you how old our stove is, but what are these people going to do in that 15-year does that time frame start from, say, we put this bill in next year and it's 15 years from that point? And what are the advantages I know there's a small amount of money for grants to low-income people, and I don't know what those low-income levels are or anything, but there are a lot of people who are becoming more and more low-income or no-income people, and how will they be able to abide by the law if this is implemented?
Well, Chair Cannon and Representative Boone, I'm not sure I can speak adequately to your comment, and it is a valid concern as well, which, as you note, there isn't a lot of funding connected with this bill, and I would be all for increasing that, but considering the economic times that the state finds itself in, and I would hope that DEQ would address those concerns when they get to the rulemaking state.
Follow-up. That is a concern of mine for my constituency, and I'm sure others around the state, and very much want to clean up the air. Some people do not have a chance. Some people in my district do not have electricity, and after this last winter, some of those who did have electricity had it off for 19 and 25 days, depending on where they lived in our district. And they work in below freezing temperatures, kept alive by their their wood stove, their gravity feed water, and in some cases their water was frozen too, and they had to just melt snow. And it got pretty primitive. But I know that's not a continual situation. But I am concerned about not having. I couldn't find it in the bill. Not having an out for people in that case, or to have. Even people who are not that poor, for one thing, but who have their whole home environment built around wood heat and, you know, a totally non-dependent on the service of utilities type living situation, which there are many in our state.
Well, Chair Cannon and Representative Boone, I absolutely acknowledge your concerns, and the only counterpoint that I would like to offer is the fact that if we can help by supporting this as a small measure to help improve the air quality, that will help to reduce our health care costs when we're addressing people with a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and emphysema and that those health costs. So it's a trade-off, and I really don't have a specific answer for you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just point out there's the areas that there are a couple of particular areas that are particularly bad for this in that sense, and not all areas of the state are in that situation with their airflow situation, et cetera, and you don't get inversions at the coast, you don't get things like that, and they seem to be captured. It's a statewide application. I would really like to see something like this. As we see in so many other bills in this building, they apply to one area of the state, but they affect everybody in that sense, sometimes unnecessarily.
So, thanks for the comment. And actually, I think Andy and I would like you to come back up. We're going to be back and forth all afternoon, I think. But to address perhaps any of the issues that Representative Boone has raised, and then I have a couple of other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy Ginsberg with EQ. And Representative Boone, just to make sure that it's clear, the bill only requires removal of an uncertified stove when a home is sold. So as long as somebody's not selling their home, it doesn't matter if the stove is 30 years old or 40 years old or 50 years old, nothing has to happen. And so as Mr. Ledger mentioned, that the idea of this bill was to try and make it painless. And so the point of sale of a home would be a time when an uncertified stove could be removed, and it doesn't necessarily have to even be replaced if there's other central heat in the home. The new owner can decide what they want to do. If it's a centrally heated with wood, it is exempt in the bill. So this would just be for, you know, an additional wood heater that's not the central heating system, and it would only apply at the point when the home is sold.
Okay, thank you.
I'm trying. Do you want to ask the question?
Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
We were just passing notes back and forth to make sure we understand. You know, on page 2, line 43 there at the bottom starts with masonry fireplaces built on home sites, etc. So, are we talking about classic aesthetic, for lack of a better word, classic fireplaces in homes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, so that definition is in there because those are exempt from the bill.
They're exempt.
Yeah. So the bill does not apply to masonry heaters, and it doesn't require removal of fireplaces either. We're talking about wood stoves.
So it's freestanding or insert, those are the kind of things, but not your classic, look at this lovely home with two wood-burning fireplaces.
Not the brick and mortar, that doesn't have to be.
Even at the time of the sale.
Correct.
I'm just making sure I got this.
Great, yeah, but I think my confusion had to do with that exemption because it I'm not sure what it means for a, when it says that the solid fuel burning device does not include masonry fireplaces to be used with an open combustion chamber. I didn't know how limiting that was or whether that is, in fact, everything that we know as a fireplace has an open combustion chamber, and they are sort of open, and there is combustion, so maybe yes.
Mr. Chair, we worked on the definition of masonry fireplace with the masonry fireplace industry and specifically defined it as they requested. So the commission could require, for example, a new masonry fireplace that was being installed to meet a certain performance standard, but an old one could not be required to be removed. So the only thing that could be removed would be the wood stove, something that's really removable.
Okay, let's go back to that then. It could require some modification in a new construction or a renovation.
Not necessarily renovation, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. It would be if the bill would authorize the commission to set standards for a new masonry fireplace, so they would have to design it so that it reduces emissions. The industry would point out, though, that they are relatively low emissions already relative to a wood stove compared to the amount of heat they produce.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Pitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, the bill goes a little further than just the prohibition on the sale. It also extends authority to the DEQ to curtail use of these devices during periods of air stagnation, and also that would expand two pellet stoves. The department apparently thinks it needs that additional authority. At least it's asking for it in this bill. So, because the bill is a lengthy device, can you kind of give us or give me a summary of just maybe the four or five things it's trying to do? I think we've got the first three.
Okay.
What are the others?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, just on the curtailment piece, currently that's a strategy that's used by a number of local governments to meet the fine particulate standard, so that when they have a day where the inversion is bad, and they're likely to have a violation, the local government will call a no-burn day. And there are usually several levels involved in that where on a low level, they'll curtail burning unless of only uncertified stoves, for example. And on a really bad day, they'll curtail all burning unless it's your sole source of heat. And so normally, currently, all of those programs are implemented by local governments, and this bill, I think it's primarily existing language, gives us authority as a backup if the local governments don't implement a program and it's needed, that we could implement it. But all of them are currently implemented by local governments. So just to answer your question then, and just to summarize, the primary and most important provision in the bill is a requirement to remove uncertified stoves upon sale of home. And the bill also authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to update the certification requirements. It's currently an EPA-run program, so stoves are certified by EPA nationally, but there's a number of types of stoves that are exempt from their program, so this bill would allow our commission to require the exempt stoves to meet standard as well. It would also allow us to go beyond the federal standards if EPA doesn't update their standards, which we expect them to. And then finally, it prohibits the burning of certain prohibited materials inside that are already prohibited to be burned outside.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that pellet stoves had been accepted from the curtailment, but that is changed here. And pellet stoves, if they're in a non-attainment area, can be regulated. that's an expansion to include pellet stoves. So one might wonder if this prohibition against the use of pellet stoves is in this bill, why isn't it expanded to include all of the stoves? There seemed to be a carve-out, a 15-year space where your stove would be safe. A pellet stove fits within that, but you're taking it out here. Why are pellet stoves called out and not the others?
Mr. Representative Benson, would help if you could point me to a line number.
I'm sorry, page 8, line 21.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, a curtailment program is used on just those days where we expect to actually exceed the federal standard. It's a day where the inversion is bad and the air pollution is building up. We're seeing it in our monitors. We see it in the National Weather Service forecast for air stagnation, and we're concerned about having an exceedance of the standard. So it's a requirement that kicks in only on those worst days, and it's designed to avoid having that fourth highest level be above the standard, which causes a violation. So it's used only on those worst days. And as I mentioned, the local governments operate all the curtailment programs, and we do have authority as a backup if a local government doesn't want to or doesn't implement a curtailment program that we could. And this provision, I haven't looked at it in a while, so I had to refresh myself with it. Pellet stoves are much, much cleaner than even certified wood stoves. And so you know, if you had a hierarchy or curtailment, you might first curtail an uncertified stove, and then you might curtail a certified stove, and the last step you might get to would be to curtail a pellet stove because they're very clean. So, but this does allow us in a period of severe air stagnation, if it were necessary to avoid an exceedance, to curtail all burning. But again, remember, it would be only if there's a backup source of heat. If this was your sole source of heat, it wouldn't apply, and it would just be for that day.
Representative Betts. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Andy, I'm just trying to get at what's safe for somebody to buy. What can they actually be sure isn't really curtailed? Should they just avoid anything that burns wood altogether and forget it? Is that the message that's being sent by this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, we definitely would not recommend against buying wood stoves or against certified wood stoves or pellet stoves. They're you know, compared to an uncertified stove, they're much, much cleaner. Natural gas is cleaner yet. Electricity is cleaner yet in terms of the local airshed. So, but these. You know, those areas that are violating the standard, which right now is only Klamath Falls and Oak Ridge, and a few other areas that are you know, have programs in place to prevent violations, it is possible on a really severe day that those types of stoves could be curtailed.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks very much. I think that's all we have today for testimony. Members, although this is a DEQ bill, it would be great to move it forward with some degree of consensus. If that's not possible, let me know, but I will schedule this for work session very shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Will we be receiving the fiscal on this so we have some idea? Because it seems to me.
You have it
in your
package?
I
have it in there.
Does it call out? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Does it call out the. It looks to me as if because of these additional regulatory options given to the DEQ, there's got to be some additional FTE required. I'm just wondering if it's called out in the fiscal.
I think if you look at the fiscal statement, it should be toward the back of the packet that you received. Under the comments section, second paragraph, it reads, DEQ indicates that this bill can be implemented with existing resources.
Thank you.
Thanks. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 102 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 104. And Andy, you're back up. And John and Catherine Vanetta, you're on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill, hopefully, was a little bit simpler to explain. It's a technical correction of a bill that was adopted last session. It only applies to the largest industrial facilities that have air quality permits, and those are permitted under Title V of the Clean Air Act, so we call it the Title V permitting program. And the Clean Air Act, as well as state law, the Federal Clean Air Act, as well as state law, requires that the Title V permitting program be 100% funded by permit fees. So that program has a fee program that's primarily based on the emissions from Title V facilities. Last session, we had Senate Bill 107, which adjusted the fees for Title V permits, and we also included a streamlining measure in that bill. That has to do with updating the fee, because under the federal law, because it's required to be 100% fee-funded program, the federal law also requires us to adjust the fee for inflation each year, so it's indexed to the Consumer Price Index. And every year, the Environmental Quality Commission has to adopt a rule to increase the fees based on the increase in the Consumer Price Index. So last session, as a streamlining measure, we changed that so the commission could adopt the fee, the Consumer Price Index adjustment, every other year. So we would do one rulemaking instead of two. And unfortunately, we missed one small point, which makes it impossible to do that, which is the date the Consumer Price Index is actually published, and it gets published after the date the commission would have to know it in order to do a two-year fee schedule instead of a one-year fee schedule. So what this bill does is aligns the Consumer Price Index definition that Oregon uses with the federal definition. ARC definition is a calendar year, and the federal definition is a fiscal year. And so by aligning our definition with the federal definition, we get the data earlier, and we can do the two-year schedule and have the streamlining effect of that. The bill also does allow us, if necessary, to do a rulemaking once a year instead of once every other year. And that's, for example, we'll have to do that the first year to get onto the two-year schedule. We'll need to do two rulemakings. But after that, our hope is to do a rulemaking every other year. So basically, to make a long story short, in trying to streamline the rulemaking process to be an every other year effort, last session, we missed one point that makes it impossible to do that. This bill just aligns the Consumer Price Index definition with the federal definition. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Boone.
Not a question, but Andy, I wish everybody would three-hole punch their papers because they fit nicely into the notebook.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John and Catherine, come on up.
Members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. We support this bill. As you heard, on the Title V sources, of which many of our members are, they pay a fee, and every year it goes up automatically by CPI, had for many years. And DEQ came in and made a pitch that they needed more resources. The CPI hadn't kept up with some of their costs. It was a pretty dramatic increase. It was about 25-27% on top of the CPI. And they made their case, and they made a good case. We took a hard look at it, and we worked the bill a little bit, and we came to an agreement that it would get bumped up about 25-27% on top of CPI, and then go up with CPI after that forever. So it's a pretty good bump. I don't know if we would agree to that today, but we did. And the way the bill was written, it was a flaw in it, and they didn't get the full amount that we all agreed to. And this would correct that. And so it would raise our fees a little bit. I don't know how much. I don't want to know. But it would bring it in compliance with the agreement that the legislature, I think, intended, and that we attended, and that the agency intended also. So this is something we would like to see pass through.
Thanks.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. You have my written testimony in summary. We support Senate Bill 104. We were part of the deal that was struck with the department in actually starting back in 2006 when we started working on this issue for the need of more funding. We worked on the bill last session, Senate Bill 107, and we agreed to that fee increase. This is a technical correction. Actually, when DEQ found out that they had a problem with this, they came to us and asked help about how to solve it. And one of our members that has 2 degrees in nuclear engineering plus an MBA solved the issue, and that's the solution you see in front of you. Because we're all struggling with that. So this is an engineered solution, so to speak.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't enjoy that level of education, so I have to ask this question. On page one, the deletion of the 2 years in line seven, why is that happening then?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bence, on line seven of the bill, that was altered last year to say that DEQ would do rulemaking every 2 years. And it was the ability to go to 2 years that got us into the trouble because the time of when the CPI is published versus the two-year schedule doesn't line up. So we're taking out the every 2 years right there and making a change on page two of the bill, lines 7 and 8. To allow flexibility about when the rulemaking is done, because DEQ has a certain schedule of when they bill our facilities for this. And I make no bones that these are very large bills that we get, and we would like them to come on a regular basis. So this is to accommodate the regular basis of our billings and to take out the every two-year reference, which would allow them to go into rulemaking on a temporary basis and then go in at their design every 2 years after that.
Thank you. Thanks. Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 104. And members, given the length and complexity of 102, I thought it would be wise to spend at least another couple of days with it. But to the extent that it's possible with these Senate bills to hear them and move them, that will depend on their complexity and the level of controversy associated with them. I'd like to do that, and this is a case where I hope that we are able to move it onto the floor today. So with that, I would accept the motion, and then we'll discuss.
Mr. Chair, question?
Question.
Does this have a subsequent to Ways and Means?
It does, yes.
Why is that?
It involves $190,000 of other funds, and we are in the habit, at least this session, of sending these types, even other funds, bills to Ways and Means.
And it didn't.
It did not get it. The Senate president operates under a different sort of set of principles on these referrals. And so in some cases, he has sent bills directly across his floor that will need a subsequent in this chamber. So. this will not be the last time.
Does this bill doesn't directly have any budgeting effect, does it?
Andy is saying, no, it will not directly have any budgeting effect.
I mean, they still have to get an appropriations to spend the money.
Yes.
You know, it might be useful to take another day and actually inquire whether the Speaker really intends this bill to go to Ways and Means when it has no budget effect at all.
We'll take your advice.
Okay.
That closed the work session on Senate Bill 104. Thank you, Representative Barnhart, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 105. Mr. Carlo. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, My name is Les Carlo. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at DEQ's Office of Compliance Enforcement. I apologize if I'm not talking loud. I have a little bit of laryngitis today. So I'm here to urge your support of Senate Bill 105A. In 1973, the state adopted a statutory maximum penalty of $10,000 for violations of pollution control laws. That was 25 years ago, and during that period, inflation has chipped away at the value of $10,000, so that $10,000 penalty assessed today is only worth 20 to 25% of what it was worth in 1973. The bottom line is that penalties today are not as potent as they were anticipated and expected to be in 1973. We're concerned that some potential violators may not be as concerned about penalties as they once were, and we're concerned that this interferes with our ability to maintain and stimulate compliance and to protect public health and the environment. The bill raises that $10,000 penalty, maximum penalty, to $25,000 maximum penalty. Now, I want to be clear that this $25,000 maximum penalty is the maximum, that is the ceiling for what a penalty could be assessed. The actual dollar value of a penalty is assessed according to factors that are established in the statutes already and rules and formulas that are in the Department of Environmental Quality rules. And I can talk more about those. I know there were some questions that came up about that previously on Senate Bill 102, so I'm happy to answer some questions about that. Under the existing $10,000 penalty maximum, the average penalty assessed in 2008 was $3,900 using those formulas and those rules. The most egregious penalties or most egregious violations receive penalties higher than that $3,900. Individuals, lesser violations, less important violations received under the $3,900, and there were many violations that weren't deemed by DEQ sufficiently significant to assess any penalty at all. Well, the bill also makes a couple of other changes. I wanted to discuss those. Recently, the state of Washington increased penalties that could be assessed for negligent spills of oil into water in the state to $100,000, and a penalty for intentionally or recklessly discharging oil into waters of the state to $500,000. This bill follows their lead in increasing a penalty from an existing $20,000 a day to $100,000 a day for negligently or intentionally discharging oil into waters of the state. And because other hazardous materials have equally damaging effects, the bill also would apply to hazardous materials, benzene, toluene, any of the solvents, anything that's listed as hazardous materials under existing statutory law. The bill also increases a penalty that we call the super penalty, which is a penalty that would apply when there's extreme environmental damage. And that existing penalty is $100,000. The bill would increase that to $250,000. One more. There currently is a loophole in the criminal code. Because of a provision in the criminal code, corporations are subject to lower fines if convicted of an environmental crime than any other legal entity, like an individual, a corporate, or an individual, a estate, partnership, any other legal entity is subject to higher penalties under the criminal code for environmental violations than corporations. I believe that was not intended in 1993 when we adopted the Environmental Crimes Act, and so the bill corrects that loophole. DEQ is committed to improving environmental quality, and I'd like to consider this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here. I think this bill provides a real opportunity for the agency to provide some context and color, if you will, about how it assesses penalties. And, you know, we hear these maximums, and if you're, you know, an individual out there struggling to make ends meet, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 potentially sounds like a heck of a lot of money. And what I hope is that it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, that you can, after this committee hearing, provide information to the committee that describes the way these are actually assessed. And, you know, the average of $3,900, that could mean a lot of things, right? It could mean that, you know, individuals typically get $3,900, or it could mean there are a few big polluters who occasionally get a $15,000 and a whole bunch of people who are getting hit with fines that are much less than $3,900. So providing some more context on what these penalties actually mean for Oregonians who run afoul of DEQ's rules and laws would I think be very, very helpful.
And Chair Cannon, if I may, I'm happy to describe that process now if you want to. I'm also happy to provide the rules and any other information. But because of the way the formula works, considering a number of factors, I'm not sure that the written materials would be more enlightening for your purposes than just a narrative discussion. So I'm happy to do that if you would like.
Sure. Go ahead and summarize it now. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it.
Understood.
But again, there is a perception. I mean, I've heard it that DEQ is aggressive with fines. There's also a perception, I've heard this even more, that DEQ is not aggressive enough with fines. So, I mean, look, both voices are out there. But speaking in particular to the view that, you know, DEQ aggressively goes after fines at the upper end of this current $10,000 ceiling would be, mm-hmm. I think, be helpful to see mm-hmm. what the reality is on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, any of the statutes, loop permits, orders, any of the prohibitions or requirements that DEQ administers are subject to a possible penalty, and the statutory penalty is $10,000 for those. We don't normally assess anywhere near that $10,000 per day. Sometimes we do. In our rules, we have made sure that there is a possibility of enforcement of all of the laws that there are. You know, Abraham Lincoln said that laws without enforcement are just good ideas, and unless there's a possibility of enforcement, we can't really administer those programs. DEQ learns about violations through various ways of compliance monitoring actions, through complaint response, through inspections. Most violations that DEQ identifies are not subject to penalties. DEQ deals with those through an informal means, gets people on the right track, educates them on the needs to do things. There are some violations that rise to a level of importance that DEQ does feel the need to do enforcement with. Things that are more likely to result in environmental damage, things that are more important to the regulatory program, like operating with a permit, those are things that are more likely to receive informal enforcement. Things that happen more often, or things that are repeated, or if someone has been chronic or recalcitrant, are more likely to come to formal enforcement. And violations that are done recalcitrantly or with a higher mental state after DEQ's told them again and again about it are more likely to have higher penalties. And so that's why it's difficult to describe exactly what the penalty would be for burning inside or other violations, because there's all these factors involved. I mean, typically the penalty, I think under our existing penalties, there wouldn't be any applicable penalty at all for this violation, because it wouldn't be a violation. If that 102 were passed, DEQ would have to look at that violation and decide how often it wanted to refer, or how often it wanted to do enforcement on those violations. I suspect not very often, because under our current guidance, even for open burning violations like the burn barrels, like the burn piles, most of those, almost all of those, don't receive enforcement. Most of those are dealt with informally by the fire departments or follow-up communications from DEQ. So it's unlikely that especially in the near term, as we start to administer that program, it's unlikely that we would do any enforcement on that at all. I assume that if a person kept doing it again and again, and we continued to get more and more complaints about it, eventually we'd need to do something. It could be the police respond if any violation can possibly be either civilly or criminally prosecuted if it rises to that level. Typically, it wouldn't be. I'd be amazed if we had any enforcement on those at all in the near term. When DEQ does initiate a formal enforcement action, we apply these rules and the formulas in the rules on what the penalty would be. And those rules consider the size of the entity, whether it's a large corporation or a large community. They consider the significance of the violation, how environmentally damaging it is, how important the violation is to the regulatory program. They consider the past history of the person. They consider how long the violation happened. They consider the mental state, whether the violation was accidentally done, negligently, intentionally done. And they consider whether the person worked to try to correct the violation, and they consider economic benefit, whether the person gained money, a financial advantage through the violation. So all of those things are wrapped into doing our formal enforcement actions. I think under our existing guidance, under our existing rules, the fireplace violations probably wouldn't receive any penalty. If they did, my guess is that under our current rules, that penalty would be far less than $1,000 if it got to that at all, at that level at all, which I think is unlikely.
Okay, and I really appreciate that. Perhaps I'm the only one interested, but I think I would at least appreciate seeing the rules that pertain to the enforcement of penalties, as well as any formulas. And if that's extraordinarily complex because of the range of violations we're talking about, fine. But you actually managed to pretty succinctly kind of summarize those rules, and I think that would be very helpful to see.
I'm happy to do that.
Thanks. Any other questions, Representative Smith?
And you mostly covered it, and to the extent you want to amplify your answer, feel free. To the extent you want to talk to me in the hallway, feel free. But there's, some social science. Okay, I'll say it's poker. So limit poker, people bet higher in limit poker than in no-limit poker. Because when they see the sky, they get scared and they want to stay close to the ground. When they see a limit, they approach the limit, right? So any time we're setting limits, I do have sort of a natural concern related to Chair Cannon's questions, and some of your answer was helpful for me, and it doesn't cure my curiosity completely.
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, I guess in partial response, the one thing I'd elaborate on is that what we've tried to do through our rulemaking and the formulas and the rules is we recently redid those rules with a very public process involving an advisory committee comprised of industry, environmental groups, past violators, and a number of other people. And what we tried to do on those formulas is use as much of the range of the penalties as we could, from about $100 to the $10,000. That's what, because it's also important that the penalty process and the penalties be seen as fair, and that we apply them consistently. And so if a person has a very minor violation and receives the same penalty as another person who has a very major violation, that's not seen typically as fair. And so the formulas have tried to distribute penalties over that range. Now, I should say this also. Nothing would change about the penalties that we assess if the bill were changed until the rules are once again changed. The formula right now specifies what the penalties would be, and those ranges would be the range is up to $10,000. So very little would change. It would require rulemaking from DEQ, and we would once again convene an advisory committee and distribute the formula. Is somewhere under $25,000. Whether it would go up to the peak of $25,000 or not, I couldn't say. That ability probably would be reserved for the director in extreme cases. But what the formula would be, I couldn't say until we convene that committee.
Representative Smith, are you considering an amendment to remove the limits altogether?
No, but industry might consider it. It'd probably scare them, but it actually might help them.
Thanks for that. Thanks for the comment, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It happens I've been involved in a number of these cases, and I've actually dealt with the Matrix. In fact, it was with a assistant attorney general named Jeff Huntington most recently, but that's been a few years ago. It happens that there are two levels of subjectivity in this process that are frightening, particularly where we see the DEQ's authority being dramatically expanded in many of the bills we've been dealing with over the past 90 days. And the subjectivity arises from, first, the nature of the areas in which you regulate, which by their nature are subjective. Secondly, they come up because the matrix that is applied is subjective. This gives undue power to those that wield it, and it's unfortunate. I understand what needs to be done. There needs to be a penalty. And I also understand that it's got to be large. $10,000 a day is a lot of money. And I'm just curious how many times the DEQ has actually enforced a $10,000 a day penalty over the past 10 years.
Chair Cannon, Chair Benz, I don't have the numbers for how many of the penalties have approached $10,000. I don't have that number. DEQ does about 200 penalties a year, and the average is, I can tell you the average is 3,900. How many are at $10,000? I couldn't say.
Chair, my client was really lucky in this case with Assistant Attorney General Huntington, because his approach was extremely rational and very, very reasonable. And so that was a fortunate thing, because, again, the subjectivity was there. The DEQ folks had made the decision that it was up to the Assistant AG to determine how to manage the case. And so I am reluctant, unless you have a history of needing to have more of a hammer, and that's why I ask, how many times have you actually needed something bigger than $10,000 a day? Because that's a lot of money. And then to go to, looks like $100,000, you're jumping from $20,000 to $100,000. In each of these instances, I must say, I don't want to leave the state of Oregon and all of its residents subject to whoever might be working for the DEQ. I want more clear rules. Mm-hmm. And sadly, being familiar with this, very familiar with this situation that you've gone through, you can tighten it down as much as you want, but at the end of the day, it's still going to be subjective. And therefore, the only thing I have to protect the people is that lid. So I'm very anxious to hear how many times you needed something greater than $10,000 a day.
Chair Ken, Representative Benz, if I may respond. So, two responses. One is first the subjectivity aspect of it. It's true that we have environmental law specialists who go through the facts and draft what they believe to be the case that matches the facts to the standards established in the statutes and the rules. All of the DEQ penalties, however, are subject to a contested case process at which DEQ would have to make its case on the facts and the law. So there is, I suppose, some subjectivity, if you will, in what those mean, but it wouldn't be DEQ. It would be the administrative law judge in those matters.
I just might mention that there is no provision for the state to pay the attorney fees for the folks when they take on that contested case defense, nor is there any particularly good way for them to go hire all of the engineering and other things that need to be done to prove or disprove that which the DEQ has marshaled its forces and created. So once again, I am not suggesting I want to support pollution of any sort, but I am concerned about the nature of the penalty, because this is a penalty. It's on top of the cleanup cost. Am I right there?
That's
this is
correct.
Not to go pay for the cleanup. You clean it up and then you pay the penalty on top. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Bernhardt.
Excuse me, if I may just respond to the other point, which Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, you'd asked about penalties, especially in the case of spills, if we'd needed higher penalties for cases where there'd been spills, that $20,000 to $100,000.
There are two kinds of cases where penalties are especially important. Higher penalties, higher than $10,000, would probably be especially important. One is violations where the economic benefit that a person received through the violation is more than the $10,000. So the person would do the violation, make a gain, an economic gain, pay penalty, and then still come out financially ahead. So that would be one circumstance. The other is in cases that are very short violations, like spills, where a big environmental damage can happen very quickly, but there's really only one day of violation. And so that's why we're proposing moving that one up.
Representative Berger.
We're talking about a per-day penalty, and you indicated that the average was 3,000 some odd, and that the exact number isn't important for the question. What portion of these penalties do you actually penalize for more than one day? And what would the fine or the penalty be over the period of time that you're penalizing for?
Chair Cannon, I'm Representative Barnhart. That $3,900 that I mentioned was for a single penalty on a single day. It's not uncommon for DEQ to find more than one violation or to find violations that have been repeated over multiple days. It's not our general practice to assess multiple penalties for multiple days absent aggravating circumstances like violations in various programs, violations that that a person knew about if they'd acted recalcitrantly, and so it's not a practice to do that. But statutorily, each violation on each day could receive the same could receive its own penalty.
So, if I may, so if someone is polluting and either doesn't understand the rules or doesn't realize they're polluting, and it goes on for some time, and then someone comes along and complains, and they stop polluting, they do something to make it stop happening. How would you assess the fine? Would you assess it every day for 3 months, or would you do it once, or what would you do?
Well, Chair Kinnon, Representative Barnhart, it's not DEQ's goal to assess penalties that would hobble a person or a company. I mean, it's certainly possible that some companies can't financially operate within the law with their economic situation, and it's certainly possible. But DEQ's goal always is to first try to obtain compliance. And if a person has been operating out of compliance for a long period of time, we have no reason to know, or we think that they didn't know that they were even violating, and we discover them out of violation, we wouldn't be assessing each separate day of violation. We have a long history of doing that.
You would not do that?
We would not assess. I apologize for my voice.
I just wasn't sure I heard the not.
Yes, we would not do that. That's come up frequently in lots of programs. We've had programs where small companies needed air contaminant discharge permits, and we find them, and they've done very well economically in the past years. It started out very small, didn't need a permit at the time, and over time they grew and grew, and now they need a permit. And it wouldn't be DEQ's goal to now all of a sudden play gotcha and to assess penalties that would hobble them. Our goal would be to get them under the permit. There may be a larger penalty because of the economic benefit, avoiding permit fees and the like, but typically they wouldn't receive many numerous days.
Thank you. A different topic, slightly different topic. One of the things you indicated was that one of the reasons for a larger penalty might be because of the economic benefit to the company of continuing to pollute. Could you describe cases in which that's occurred or in which it appeared as though it might occur? So that what I'm trying to get at is whether the $10,000 a day figure is really adequate in dealing with that scenario, or if there are situations in which you need more in order to prevent an ongoing pollution because the the benefit of the pollution is so much more valuable to the company than the $10,000 they're being charged.
Chair Cannon, Representative Barnhart, to answer that question, I think I need to take one step back and describe a little bit about how we do economic benefit. When we're looking at what the penalty portion of the economic benefit is, we try to estimate the amount of money that would put the person back where they had been had they complied. And so it's not simply a matter of looking at the costs that they should have spent. It's much more complicated than that. And we have a computer model that was created by the federal government in a public notice and comment process called the Ben model. And it considers such things as interest rates, inflation, whether a cost was avoided or delayed, the type of entity, the tax consequences to that particular type of entity, and many other factors. So there are cases where a person should have done things that they ought to, or had not done things that they ought to have done. Some types of violations where a company needed to put in a piece of air pollution control equipment, for example. Sometimes those pieces of equipment can be very expensive, and if you look at the cost of equipment plus the avoided engineering costs plus the utilities needed to run the thing over time, that we can be talking quite a bit of money. Typically what we do in those cases is if the company does put the equipment in, we look at delayed costs. And so those reduce the costs quite a bit. Those costs can exceed $10,000, and the economic benefit for some of those things can exceed $10,000 as well. It's possible.
I mean, I'm assuming we're talking about many days.
Well, the pollutant control equipment example may not be a good one for the per-day example. One that we do see from time to time is open burning. A contractor may demolish a house or two or a few structures, take the debris somewhere, and burn it. So we have a burn that happened on one day, and instead of taking the debris to the solid waste disposal or recycling it in some way, whatever options would legally be allowable, instead they burned it. And so it's a violation that may have happened on one day, but the avoided good disposal costs can exceed $10,000 per day.
That is a better example. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for your testimony. It's interesting how we might react to these numbers in very different ways based on our own personal histories and experiences. I mean, I hear this number. I think I got this correct. You assess 200 penalties a year, just 200. I mean, given all the regulatory power that we here, DEQ, has, the fact that statewide jurisdiction, you assess just 200 penalties a year?
That's correct.
Okay. I mean, to me, that's my guess would have been many magnitudes greater than that, and I find that very interesting. At the same time, it is important to me to get more context on these penalties. The average of 3,900 doesn't help me a lot. Hearing some of these stories related to sort of here's a case and the economic benefit that might have accrued and the fee that went along with it, that's helpful. Getting some sense of, within the 0 to 10,000, we're only talking about 200 a year, so it should be possible to give this committee a sense of how many of those are bunched down low and how many of them are up high. So I am asking for some more of that information to enable us to make a decision on this issue.
Chair Cannon, may I make one small response there? And that is, you'd ask if there are more. We are, enforcement's expensive. While we don't pay the attorney fees if we lose, as may happen in some court proceedings, enforcement's still expensive for the state. Getting the inspectors together, getting the legal analysts together, we do pay for the hearings. So these are expensive proceedings. The department is looking at various ways to try to streamline some of those processes, including some ticketing possibilities. The tanks, our underground storage tank program, has operated a ticketing program for some period of time, and we're looking at trying to apply those principles in other programs as well. So we do hope to increase the number of cases that we handle through these streamlined manners.
Thank you. Representative Smith, did you want to make a comment or question?
So is it that people are nice and that 200 is just as many as there are, and is kind of a lot. I don't know if it's a lot or a little. Is it that people are hard to catch? Is it that it's too expensive to catch them? Or is it you don't have enough people to catch them? Or am I just wrong and 200 is kind of a lot?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, I think that's a difficult question to ask. We do find more than 200 violations a year using the resources that we have and our decisions about what the importance of the violation is. We have guidance to staff on which cases to refer for this formal enforcement process, and that ends up being about 200 a year. So,
I'm going to follow up.
So the conservative Chicago school deterrence-based penalizing, which despite my political party, I to some degree ascribe to, says you set your level of penalty at a level that reflects to some degree the percentage incidence or the likelihood of the violation, so that if a mathematically cognizant actor, unlike many criminal deviants, but maybe not entirely unlike more savvy operators who have to think about cost of doing business and why do they want to mess with us environmental crap, and is there sort of calculating decisions or just, you know, whatever. Do we do any math to figure out sort of the number of violations we think that happen, the number, out of those, the amount, you know, I've heard, for instance, in private tort law that we figure blank percentage, some say it's about 85 to 95% of torts get lumped, like people don't pursue them, right? So tort penalties are allowed to drift slightly higher, and that's why some economists would say that that punitive damages are not entirely stupid, because you thump somebody just a little bit harder, so you manage the fact that lots of people don't ever get thumped at all. Okay. Mm-hmm. So have we ever done any math to figure out how many sort of bad things we think are happening that aren't getting caught, so that we're setting a deterrence level that's appropriate? So if there is a rational actor, knowing that a lot of people aren't rational actors, but if there is a rational actor, they can't make a rational decision to say, it's actually cheaper for me to violate and probably not get caught, pay if I do, and that's a better bet than complying with the law. Have we done that math?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, we've thought a lot about those principles. That's difficult math to get at. As penalties, we know, create deterrence by basically three factors: the size of the penalty, the size of the possible penalty, how many penalties there are, that is the risk of the penalty, and then how fast the penalty gets to them, so how fast the sting is associated with the penalty. And we've done some surveys with the public and with industry to try to ascertain what helps them to comply. I mean, what stimulates their compliance? What pieces of enforcement are important to them in their thinking as they make decisions on compliance? We have some ideas about that. We hope to be able to measure those things better in the future. But what you ask is a difficult question and something that's being talked about quite a great deal nationally. And this is an issue that states are struggling with as we try to better describe the successes of our regulatory programs. It's something we've thought about. You're asking for numbers. We don't have numbers.
All right, sorry. Well, that's a follow-up. And my own policy preference would be faster, smaller penalties rather than slower, more expensive to administer, bigger penalties. For me, the goal, and probably for everybody, the goal would not be how many people can be penalized, but how can we achieve a goal of compliance, right? And my guess is longer, slower, more delayed, contested, larger complaints that you might be able to not get caught for yield a goal of compliance less well. Then maybe that's the ticketing thing you're talking about. So let's say there were some policy preference that other people might agree with me, and I don't know if they do, but I just know what I think. Let's say there were some policy preference for that. Would that policy preference be reflected within your agency, violated by your agency, thought stupid by your agency, being pursued by your agency, or something else?
Chair Cannon, Representative Smith, I think that is a policy that is accepted in our agency. If you look at the enforcement that our agency does compared to EPA, for example, in its programs, EPA typically does fewer penalties but much larger penalties in a given time. So our agency, with our 200 penalties a year, is still more than many states are doing and EPA. So our penalties, we believe, are more. We're looking at a two-pronged approach in some. To get back to your point, we're making a two-pronged approach, I think, in many of our programs. We do want large penalties for significant, visible violations because we want people to see the large penalties. Large penalties are more likely to be published in the papers, more likely for people to hear about them. That helps in creating deterrence. But we also agree that we want more numerous penalties, especially and with the regulatory dollars we have for enforcement, and are looking at doing some ticketing programs in some of the programs. So I think we're looking at both of those prongs.
I lied. One last one.
Yeah, very quickly. We've got still several more people to testify.
So the other, and if our, again, our objective is outcomes, not catching people, or is compliance not catching people, right? Catching people is merely something we got to do to achieve an objective of compliance. How much does the enforcement arm, and I just don't know enough about the DEQ and it doesn't report to Ways and Means Subcommittee on which I sit, how much does the enforcement arm talk to something else that's happening to help industry and other actors on the front end sort of, you know, not blow it, so their only way to achieve compliance isn't by smacking, but also by teaching, isn't only by publishing in the paper some really bad actor, and then they don't want to be that bad actor, but is also sort of giving them a tool to say, oh yeah, this is not so hard, I can do this, and here's ways you can do it and still make a profit, et cetera, et cetera.
Chair Ken, Representative Smith, if I understand your question, the staff who are doing the enforcement, doing the formal enforcement, handling those cases, are not much involved in doing educational outreach kinds of efforts. That's not to say that DEQ isn't involved in those. DEQ and its inspectors and engineers and technical experts do quite a bit of that through our small business assistance program, through technical assistance programs, through compliance assistance offered at the time of inspections, through training, through pamphlets, through many, many means. But the staff doing the formal enforcement action, they're basically administrative prosecutors, and they're not experts in those details of compliance and pollution prevention and all of that.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. If we get a written response, if it's possible for the agency to provide a written response on some of the not just smacking that they do, that's helpful to me to think about how much smacking is appropriate.
I think that would be very appropriate. So you or Greg could take that back to the director, perhaps, that we could get some sort of written response to the agency's overall sort of purpose and mission and values when it comes to ensuring compliance. Thanks. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed in the Attorney General's testimony, which you're not responsible for, but I wanted to ask you something about it. And by the way, thank you for being here. I wouldn't wish your malady on anybody but Representative Smith.
Good one.
I wondered about he mentions, you know, it's been quite a while since these fees have gone up, and he mentions the inflationary factor. And in the questions that Representative Smith was posing, is that a factor in what you're in when you make your formulas for these fees?
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, that's not. A factor. You're talking about the inflation since 1973.
No,
it's not a factor in the formula.
Okay, that's helpful.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And stick around. We may have a last question or two, but perhaps not. Let's hear from our panel: Sue Marshall, John Ledger, and Brock Howell. Brock, do you want to start?
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell. I'm an advocate for Environment Oregon, where we have 30,000 members statewide to protect clean air, clean water, and open space. And we're or I'm here in support of Senate Bill 105 as amended and before us. I'd just like to provide a perspective on this. Our goal isn't necessarily to be, or is not to be anti-business in any sort of way by increasing penalties and forcing them to pay increasingly amounts of money. Our perspective is that avoidance nearly always costs less than mitigation of environmental pollution. And so to the extent that we can reduce the amount of pollution, the less cost it is to both society and potentially those businesses that do pollute and then have mitigation costs. So with that perspective, we hope we are both being pro-environment and in some respects pro-business. And really the best approach to encouraging avoidance isn't to make this a lengthy, drawn-out process. We believe that the preferences towards reducing litigation, the length of time in determining penalties, and so that means an administrative or civil process is much more preferable than a tort or a criminal proceeding, which would be lengthened over time as to how to resolve this problem. And by making the schedule, there's some at least certainty into what penalty will be ultimately arrived at. So this presents a problem of where we're at now. The value of the civil penalty is much less today than it was when originally put into place. If it was inflated from the initial time to today, we're looking at a penalty somewhere close to about $50,000. The proposed amendment would be more like $25,000 per day for the violation. So by not increasing the penalty, if we don't do that, we're really reducing the incentive to avoid pollution and thus increasing the possibility of higher mitigation costs in the future, and also encouraging the reliance on criminal and tort proceedings to discourage pollution. And there are other bills providing more authority or more capabilities for the AG's office to, or DOJ to do that. But I think we should be encouraging this procedure to as much extent possible. And so this is the solution, is to provide this the civil penalty increase. I would like to mention a little bit about the schedule, which I just was able to look online to see what the OAR is on that. And it's the standard schedule is a cap of $8,000 for a major penalty. A moderate penalty gets cut down to $4,000, and the average penalty was said to be about $3,900. So we're looking at most penalties being somewhere, or I wouldn't say most, but the mean penalty being less than the moderate penalty on the schedule. There's much more complexity to how that schedule is arrived at or what schedule you do use, but that's the essential element. There is discretion to go up to the $10,000 penalty, but the typical schedule has a cap at $8,000. So with that, thank you for the time to talk about this, and I hope you pass Senate Bill 105.
Thanks. Go ahead, Sue.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Tualatin Riverkeepers. Brian Wigner of Tualatin Riverkeepers has already submitted some testimony to you, and I'll just hit on a few of the points that they're making. Tualatin Riverkeepers supports SB 105, increasing the maximum penalty for violations of pollution control law. We believe that ideally a high penalty would serve as a disincentive to pollute. But there's other factors, and I'm happy to hear the questioning that's occurred about compliance is really ultimately what we would like. So in addition to a sufficiently high penalty, there needs to be strategic enforcement. We've attached an article by Steve Dean of the Oregonian that lays out the last 4 years and the penalties that were assessed and the penalties that were collected. Just in 07, for those penalties that were under $10,000, 28% of those penalties were collected. For penalties that range from $10,000 to $24,999, only 2% was collected. And then for the higher penalties, presumably the more egregious cases, $25,000 to $99,999, there was zero collected. We've also included an article by about the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, a small nonprofit organization, staff of one, I believe, and rely on volunteers that were able to collect nearly twice as much as DEQ was able to collect in penalties in the past year. So sufficiently high penalties, strategic enforcement, but also we believe that DEQ needs to have sufficient resources to do the enforcement. In the Tualatin Basin, some weeks ago we had a bill before you related to an outbreak of blue-green algae. There are real downstream costs to a lack of enforcement. In this particular case, DEQ and the Department of Agriculture were contacted. There was no resolution as far as enforcement. The discharge continued for 2.5 months. It was never stopped. The cost in the community, as best we can assess, was about $500,000. Downstream is a drinking water plant that had to do additional treatment. A farmer that relied on the water for irrigation lost about $300,000 of his crop, in addition to being physically harmed by the water that he came in contact with. We believe that, and this will be a further conversation, I think, in the Ways and Means Committee, the adequacy of funding for DEQ and their enforcement program. We believe that some of these penalties that are collected should go into help bolster DEQ's enforcement efforts. I know some would argue against that, but currently DEQ is at a disadvantage and I think discouraged from enforcing because they don't have adequate staff. Now, Senate Bill 105 probably won't resolve all of the issues related to compliance and enforcement, but we think it is a good step in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Ledger again from AOI. Just a couple of quick things. First of all, other than Mr. Ginsburg and myself, we're probably the only two people that actually have done this for a living. You would not believe it, but at one time when I was skinny and had hair, I inspected sulfuric acid plants, elemental phosphorus plants with a hard hat for an agency, and worked my way up to where I was actually assessing penalties and running a compliance program and an agency. So I can tell you this is not easy. Any way you look at it is not easy, and you really can't do it totally objectively. It's hard. I could tell you an anecdote, but I will not. I'll spare you. I'll tell you later in Magoo's or someplace. One of the things I want to touch on is Oregon, unlike many, many other states, a lot of states do not have a criminal element to their environmental crimes package. Oregon was one of the first states, and I think there are a whole lot of states that do not have a criminal Environmental Crimes Act. Oregon does. So in cases where somebody does go out and knowingly says, I'm not going to do this because this is going to save me money, and they knowingly do that, I'm not a lawyer, but that smacks to me of a felony. And we have an Environmental Crimes Act. And I don't know how much it's been used, maybe not enough, I don't know, but I have a hunch it's going to be used more. All right? So if somebody is going and doing these things on purpose, that's criminal. That we have that. A lot of states don't, that have very high civil penalties. So we have these civil penalties, $10,000 a day. That mounts up because a lot of these things are ongoing. I don't know if you raised it to $25,000 a day. That would make a huge difference. If somebody's discharging into the river and poisoning people, I don't know if it would make a difference if they were subject to $10,000 a day versus $25,000. Seems to me that's something that would fall under another type of act. I think Oregon businesses, just when I look around the country, Oregon is marked a couple of ways. One is there is an extraordinarily good relationship between business and the DEQ in this state that frankly does not exist in any other state in the union. It is better than any other state in the union. I can show you stuff from the southern states where it is scorched earth between the industrial base and the agency. And sometimes we get criticized for it. Oregon businesses tend to be pretty green. They live here. I think the question would be, is this actually needed? Now, I looked at this, and in some cases, the things actually kind of surprised me that they were low. For instance, on the back page, I think on page six, section 15, like when you're having a really egregious, horrible violation, the top civil penalty was $100,000. I mean, that's like something like the Exxon Valdez going into Wizard Island or something. You know, it's going to you need something that is higher than that for something that egregious, I think. So I think some of these things probably make some sense. Open burning. Open burning is by far the biggest source of dioxin in our environment today. It's like 90%. It's horrible. You know, $100 penalty or whatever for open burning is too low. I mean, that's a chronic thing. I don't know if you really would gain much by pushing it up to $25,000 a day. I think at this time, maybe it would not be the perfect time to do it. Our members do not like to see violations. They don't have any sympathy for people who violate, frankly, because it can put them at a competitive disadvantage. And I am thankful that the DEQ did move back the effective date to 2011, so that if it does pass, gives everyone a little bit more time to know it's coming. But we are in a pretty hard recession. Things are looking bad. I don't know if this is the right time to go, okay, one of the things this place is going to do, legislature is going to do during a recession, is raise penalties on civil penalties, administrative penalties, on Oregon businesses by 250%. I'll just toss that out there for PR value, and that would really conclude my remarks.
Thank you. You don't know whether it's a good thing to do. Does AOI have a position on this bill?
AOI has a position on the bill. We would rather not see the bill pass at this time.
I will take that as a position of opposition to the bill.
Yeah.
Thanks. All right. Any further questions? Don't think so. With that, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 105 and close the Committee on Environment and Water.